This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On the eve of the 2018 Winter Olympics, let us look back at one of the most dramatic moments of the most recent Summer Games. It transpired during the opening ceremonies in Rio's most celebrated soccer stadium, the Maracanã.
Tonga!
Because television wanted prime time for this prime time event, the TV audiences in the U.S. weren't going to see the parade of athletes until an hour after it had happened.
We knew an hour in advance that Pita Taufatofua was about to take over the world in a very odd way.
That's Ben Cohen. He was in Rio covering the games for the Wall Street Journal, and he was among the first U.S. citizens to see Pita Taufatofua enter the arena wearing nothing above his waist but a glistening coat of coconut oil and a necklace made of shark's teeth.
And we sort of became obsessed with him ever since that night, because it's not every day you see an extremely shirtless, extremely oiled man holding a Tongan flag and becoming a global celebrity on, you know, one of the world's most extraordinary sports stages.
For the next 2 weeks, Pita Taufatofua, a previously unknown Taekwondo athlete, was a celebrity inside the Olympic Village and beyond. Every time he walked through the village, a runner, a jumper, a swimmer, or a volleyball player would beg him to pose for a selfie. He was offered future opportunities to model, to act, and to pose some more without a shirt. But Pita was busy preparing for his second act in Rio, his opening round Taekwondo match against a fighter from Iran.
We thought that there might be some interest in him after the opening ceremony, so we decided that we were going to own this story and just flood the zone, so we sent three people.
That's Joshua Robinson, who went along with Ben Cohen to cover Pita's bout for the Wall Street Journal.
He lost, I believe the score was 16-1, and yet the entire arena was rooting for him. He won the crowd.
They were chanting, "Tonga, Tonga," and he was waving the Tongan flag.
Pita's match lasted just 6 minutes. The loss eliminated him from the tournament, but the story doesn't end there. This is Bill Littlefield in Boston. Is this Pita?
Yes, it sure is.
I recently reached Pita Taufatofua on Skype just after he had checked into a tiny hotel room with really spotty Wi-Fi in Germany. Pita was traveling with a Chilean and a Mexican. Until a few months ago, the three had never met, and the reasons for all this will soon become apparent, if not entirely rational. Pita explained he was not particularly disappointed that he'd lost his only match in Rio.
Absolutely not. I mean, 50% of everyone that fights in a Taekwondo tournament lose their first match. It's just, you know, it's the nature of the game. And the guy was better than me on the day, and he deserved the win. I'm just happy that I fought my best.
And the chants of Tonga, Tonga that accompanied that country's only athlete at the Games, as he became one of the few losing competitors ever to provide a crowd with a victory lap?
That was a bigger win for me, because, you know, now people know where Tonga is.
Or at least some people do, and in case you don't, Tonga is an archipelago in the southern Pacific Ocean. Think Samoa, only further south, which means there's no snow there, which wouldn't matter except that Pita had such a good time at the 2016 Summer Olympics that he decided he couldn't wait to do it again until 2020. He wanted to compete in the upcoming Winter Games in South Korea. So he turned down all those modeling and acting offers, and he figured the most difficult sport for a huge Tongan to master would be cross-country skiing. So since a little over a year ago, that's what he's been trying to do.
I had absolutely no snow. I had no stamina. I had no funds. I had absolutely nothing. But I had a will. And so we found ways that I could practice. And in summer, you know, I saw that they were practicing on roller skis.
On roller skis, a cross-country skier needs only pavement to practice the motions necessary to actually cross-country ski. Great, right?
These are the worst things ever made. I tell you, the amount of concrete that I've eaten, no one should ever go through that process.
But Pita Taufatofua has gone through that process, and the process has moved him a little closer to his goal of competing at the Winter Games. The Wall Street Journal's Ben Cohen explains.
After the Sochi Games in 2014, the International Ski Federation decided, in an effort to expand its field to warm weather nations, it decided to allow points accrued in roller skiing events to count toward cross-country skiing. So it is possible to qualify for cross-country skiing at the Olympics by getting most of your points while on roller skis.
It's like qualifying to play basketball in the Olympics by building up points playing shuffleboard.
Or pop a shot, yeah.
Right, in the arcade.
I think you'll have to take your beef to the International Ski Federation, though.
Yeah, but why would I want to do that? Because why would I want to deprive a taekwondo athlete from Tonga of the opportunity to compete in cross-country skiing? And as it happens, over the past year or so, PETA has roller skied well enough so that all he needs is one vaguely decent result in a race on actual snow to make it to South Korea. Unhappily, his most recent attempt to achieve that result in Poland last weekend did not go well.
I was on my first lap and the ski, it broke off my boot and ended up going back down the hill that took me 15 minutes to ski up.
Maybe the ski broke off the boot because, well, I'll leave it to PETA to explain why his equipment isn't perhaps Olympic quality.
I've been racing on rental skis in all these races, and it turns out that the professionals have, you know, 30, 40 pairs of one ski for soft snow, one ski for hard snow, and I've only got one ski, so I guess it makes the decision easier which one to use, huh?
Happily, PETA hasn't been alone in his quest to get the last result he needs to qualify for the Winter Olympics. He's been traveling to races across Europe and training with the aforementioned Mexican and Chilean. The latter actually has some experience in the sport. He skied in a sprint event at the 2014 Games in Sochi. The Wall Street Journal's Joshua Robinson says the Tongan rookie has been trying to learn from the veteran.
I saw him give the other two a lesson on how to wax skis properly. And Jonathan, the Chilean, starts pulling out these little tubs of ski wax, telling PETA how much they cost, sometimes 40 or 50 bucks a pop. And he had 10 or 15 of them in this duffel bag, saying, well, this one is for wet snow, this one is for dry snow, this one's for hard snow. And PETA went very quiet, because all he had was one pack of wax that he'd bought on eBay, and it was for snowboards.
PETA and his two mates call themselves the Exotics, and they've pushed each other to train hard, sometimes as often as three times a day, including skiing after dark. During those sessions, they light the trails with the flashlights on their iPhones. PETA maintains that they each bring different talents to the partnership.
One guy knows how to wax skis. You know, one guy knows how to book a hotel room, I guess. We find out what resources we have and we work together. And I think that's, to me, that's the Olympic spirit. It's not all about gold medals and, you know, just destroying each other. It's actually about bringing up each other.
It's a grand and heartening vision, that is. But on a less spiritual plane, a gold medal would be welcome. PETA estimates that his quest has put him in a hole that's $30,000 to $40,000 deep.
I think I need to win the gold medal and sell it just to get back to zero.
PETA has this weekend and the next to race well enough somewhere so that the International Ski Federation will okay his participation in the games. Success doesn't seem likely, but maybe, as PETA has suggested, success as traditionally defined isn't the whole point. Trying one's best is part of the point, as is pursuing a goal about as unlikely as it could be. Joshua Robinson feels PETA Taufatofua's adventure offers us a perspective too easily buried under the noise generated by the commercial spectacle of the Games.
I think it's easy to be cynical about the Winter Olympics and the Olympics in general now. Fewer and fewer countries want to host them. There seems to be a constant hurricane of scandal, especially after Sochi with Russian doping. And when you look at PETA's story, there's nothing of that about it. He's trying to take an underrepresented country to the Olympics because he enjoyed being there and because he felt he wanted to take on a new challenge. And that's really what it should be about.
That, and whether if PETA makes it to South Korea, whether he'll wear a shirt during the opening ceremonies. I couldn't help myself. I had to ask.
Who knows? Anything can happen. It's the Olympics.
It's time for three stories you should know. And this week, we've got a trio of stories coming out of the NFL. I'm joined by The Washington Post's Cindy Boren and ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. Welcome back to both of you.
Hey, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Don, I'm going to ask you to start us off.
Well, I'm going to talk about a tale of two coaches. The story begins, it was the best of guaranteed contracts, and it was the worst of guaranteed contracts. John Gruden just signed a $100 million 10-year contract to coach the Oakland Raiders. Now, that's a big chunk of change for a guy with a fair amount of rust on him. Gruden hasn't coached since 2009. Since then, he's worked Monday nights for ESPN, of course, and become a big TV star. Gruden got paid because Mark Davis has a record $750 million in Nevada taxpayers' money defraying the cost of his new Vegas football stadium. So he's feeling flush, I guess, to let 100 mil of free money ride on John Gruden. Now, what's the complete opposite of Sin City and celebrity star power? Cincinnati and Marvin Lewis. Earlier this month, the veteran head coach of the Bengals was re-signed for 2 years. He'll be paid, well, I don't know, whatever the opposite of Gruden money is. And in 15 years as the Bengals coach, Marvin Lewis has tantalized fans in Cincy with 7 playoff appearances and lost all 7 games. This tells us a lot about the NFL's economics of expectations. For one thing, Gruden and Lewis both benefited from a perceived short bench of strong head coaching candidates. But let's look at it this way. If Marvin Lewis manages to win just one wild card game, he'll have improved. So I ask you guys, who's going to end up getting their money's worth?
Well, you know, you have to stop and think about all the money Mark Davis is saving on haircuts first. You have to factor that in as well. But what really matters in the NFL, besides a coach, you know, you need a coach like Gruden, someone who's a headliner who will come out and fan dance when they get to Vegas. But, you know, what really matters in the NFL is the quarterback. And, you know, if we're all kind of breathing deeply and looking at the $100 million contract that Gruden is going to get, just wait until you see what happens to the quarterbacks this year, guys like Kirk Cousins and Jimmy Garoppolo.
I object a lot less to whatever the owner of a pro team wants to pay his head coach than I do to college coaches in basketball and football getting $6, $7, $8, $9 million a year to coach a bunch of guys who don't get paid. I'm more uncomfortable with that.
No, I agree with you. The thing that's really striking to me is less the money and more the 10 years. I mean, that is a eternity when you're looking at coaches' tenure. The average coaching tenure in the NFL is 4.3 seasons.
Cindy, let's turn to your topic.
Okay, now, Bill, this is one I know that's going to be really close to your heart, because I know that the only thing you love more than football plays are football replays. But I think we have to address this topic after last weekend. Remember when replay used to be instant?
Sure.
Well, if we learned anything from the first weekend of the NFL playoffs, it's that what should be the most exciting, the compelling football of the season is really being dragged down to just an absolute grinding halt by these lengthy reviews by people and, you know, possibly they're mole people who never see the light of day deep in the bowels somewhere of the NFL's plush Park Avenue headquarters. It was so bad that you'll recall that NBC's Al Michaels turned into Mr. Cranky Pants, you know, wresting the nickname away from you, Bill, during the Saturday night game. During this lengthy review of the replay, when he started lamenting how great the thing is about the NHL is that the last 2 minutes takes 2 real, honest minutes. Stop and consider that for a minute. Egads, he was actually praising another sport. A friend of mine suggested, facetiously, I hope, that we all go back to the pre-replay days. That seems like a wild overcorrection. But I think everyone will admit that among the many things the NFL has to address in the offseason is this.
Well, I was struck last Saturday night during that Falcons and Rams game. The last 48 seconds of the first half took 10 minutes. I actually clocked it. There was a play and a penalty, a play, a review of that play, and the ruling was confirmed. A play, a penalty, a review, and the ruling was reversed. A play and another penalty, and then a field goal. The last 2 minutes of an NBA game don't take 10 minutes. It's bad for the game. And one of the things that the NFL should think about doing is putting a clock on the folks back at 345 Park Avenue. 45 seconds or a minute to keep the pace of the game going, because it's one of the huge issues. You know, you've got games in the playoffs going 3.5 to 4 hours, and the millennials are not going to sit still for that.
I think you guys have got this all wrong. The NFL is all about marketing. All they have to do is shift the marketing a little bit. and market the National Football League games as something that will help you go to sleep. And it's done, right, Cindy?
Oh, Bill.
And that's not cranky. That's creative.
It's creative. And, you know, frankly, it's a revenue stream that I'm stunned that no one has thought about in NFL headquarters.
It's the only thing they haven't monetized yet, Bill.
All right. My topic is last this week, but no less super for that. 5 years ago, it was decided on high that this year's Super Bowl would transpire in the $1.1 billion stadium in Minnesota. 5 years ago, the Vikings were awful. They went 5-10-1. This season, they are so good that they may become the first NFL team to play the Super Bowl in their home stadium. If that happens, what happens to the odds? Will the NFL make the Vikings stay in a hotel somewhere just like the opposing team rather than allow them to sleep in their own beds during the week before the game? How will Vikings fans react when they discover that although the Super Bowl is a home game, tickets will not be available because they've all been gobbled up by corporate partners and other one percenters? If you're a bureaucrat in the NFL office, one of those mole people perhaps, you are really hoping that anybody but the Vikings wins the NFC championship, right, Cindy?
I don't know. Aren't the prices of tickets going to go through the roof? And I believe we've established that the NFL likes money. I have a friend who has been a Vikings fan his entire life, and he is looking at buying tickets. He is convinced, and he's ready to cash in his 401k plan.
Yeah, I was going to say, I hope he has deep pockets if he's looking to buy tickets to that game. Don, you are a Vikings fan, right? So I don't know.
Yes.
This is good, right? I don't know.
I don't know if it's good. Well, first of all, I've been a Vikings fan since the age of 8. Mm. And the last time the Vikings were in the Super Bowl was in 1977. I was 13 years old, and the Raiders crushed us. The team constantly invents new ways to break my heart. Bill, if they don't make the Super Bowl, I'm going to blame you for jinxing them with this segment. I'm going to be there, guys, for ESPN. I don't have to pay for my ticket. I've got a media pass. So the pressure is even greater this year. I want to root on my team to win the Super Bowl in their home stadium. But we just got to get past Sunday's game at this point. I mean, you know, one step at a time.
I'm just terrified that Don's going to end up being a jinx. You know, all this is going to come down on Don if they don't win.
I've been blamed before by fellow Vikings fans.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Washington Post's Cindy Boren and ESPN's Don Van Notte Jr. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Bill.
Many of Fritz Pollard's gridiron opponents hated the trailblazer because he was black. Did it bother him?
I look at him and grin. Didn't get mad and want to fight him. Just look at him and grin, and the next minute run 80 yards for a touchdown.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. JCB3 recently left this review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts. This program is entertaining and funny. Don't be intimidated. There are great stories about current and past events for everyone. Thanks, JCB3. But why would anybody be intimidated by sports public radio style? Be delighted. Be astonished. Do what JCB3 did and leave us a review on Facebook, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. The reviews really do help other listeners to find our show, and thanks.
This podcast and following message sponsored by WBUR.
Hi, I'm Ben Brock Johnson, here to introduce you to Endless Thread, a new podcast from WBUR and Reddit featuring stories that capture the internet's endless permutations of human potential.
Even though it's like this huge network with millions of users, you know, there's still that kind of like small world connection there.
Endless Thread, supported by ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire, and by Wistia, where videos get put to work. Learn more at wbur.org/endlessthread and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? And what can a tuna cannery in the middle of the Pacific tell us about taxes? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator, a new podcast from Planet Money, where in every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Approximately 70% of current NFL players are African American. About 100 years ago, that figure stood at well under 1%. And one of the men in that 1% was a fascinating and often overlooked football trailblazer. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
The story of Frederick Douglass Fritz Pollard spans generations.
My earliest memory of him was when he gave me this football and would take me around in the backyard and show me how to run pass patterns.
That's Fritz Pollard III. He's the grandson of Fritz Pollard.
The first time he knocked me down, I was sort of shocked that he hit me that hard. But then I realized that I wasn't hurt, so you just get up. And you just keep getting up.
That was a lesson Fritz Pollard the Elder was well qualified to teach. Fritz Pollard was born in Chicago in 1894, the seventh of eight children. His mother was Native American, his father an African American who boxed professionally during the Civil War. Pollard ran track and played baseball and football at Chicago's Lane Tech High School, where his athleticism was celebrated. In 1915, he enrolled at Brown University on a Rockefeller scholarship, and things changed.
His teammates basically really wouldn't talk to him or anything until they saw what he could do.
What Pollard could do was rack up yards, 60, 70, and 80 yards at a time. Once he got the ball, the tough 5'6" halfback flew downfield, his trademark baggy football pants flapping in the breeze.
Once they saw his talent, he won them over, and his personality also won them over. So from then on, they had his back no matter what.
That would be useful. As the only African American on the field, Pollard was the subject of verbal abuse and worse. In the college game of 1915, punching, kicking, and eye gouging at the bottom of the pig pile were routine. Pollard was often a target.
He learned how to protect himself by rolling over and kicking his feet like a cat. If somebody tried to pile on and drag their feet on him to cut him.
His teammates also protected him.
They would all wear baggy uniforms so that way no one could tell in the game who he was. And sometimes they even darkened their faces with the shoe polish so they couldn't tell who he was.
Is that true?
Yes.
During games?
During games. Back then, you know, in 1915 and 1916, that's unheard of.
But there was little Pollard's teammates could do to protect him from abusive fans.
They had death threats when they played certain schools in certain areas. And these were Ivy League schools that still were as racist as anywhere else. It went all through the country.
There were times when he had to be escorted onto the field by the police.
That's Dr. Stephen Towns, another of Fritz Pollard's grandsons.
The Yale fans used to sing Bye Bye Blackbird when he came on the field.
Brown earned an invitation to the 1916 Rose Bowl. The New Year's Day game against Washington State almost didn't happen. Pollard's grandsons know the story, which began at the team's hotel.
They wouldn't let my grandfather sign in. So they said, well, take us back to the train station because if you won't let him stay, we're going back. Brown was going back to Rhode Island if they weren't going to let my grandfather stay in the hotel.
The team then refused to stay, and the hotel worked it out.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning they let him stay.
Pollard had become the first black player in Rose Bowl history, and he would go on to break other barriers. After a stint in the Army at the end of World War I and 3 years coaching Lincoln University's football team, Fritz Pollard signed with the Akron Pros for the inaugural season of the American Professional Football Association, the forerunner of the NFL. He was one of a handful of black players in the league, and he flourished.
He rarely came out of the game. He played quarterback, he was running back. He did punt returns, kickoff returns. He even did the punts and the kicks, where they used to do the drop kick for the field goal. There wasn't a thing he didn't touch in the game.
Pollard's accomplishments notwithstanding, Aaron Dodson of ESPN's The Undefeated says not everyone welcomed him into the pros.
And there was a group of players who just didn't really like the fact that this black man was not only in the league, but he was also an elite player in the league.
Pollard spoke about that in a 1974 NFL Films interview.
I look at him and grin. Didn't get mad and want to fight him. Just look at him and grin, and the next minute run 80 yards for a touchdown.
He did that a lot. Before the Akron Pros' first game against the powerhouse Canton Bulldogs, he tried it out on a football legend.
Jim Thorpe walked up to him and said, "Do you know who I am?" And he goes, "Yes, I know who you are. I've heard about you." And he goes, "Well, I've heard about you too." And he called him the N-word. And my grandfather, not to miss a step, called him the N-word. And Thorpe just sort of stepped back and looked at him. He said he was going to kill my grandfather. He said, "Well, if you're ready to kill me, you can find me down there in your end zone." And the opening play, my grandfather took the kickoff all the way back for a touchdown. And he's waving for Jim Thorpe to come on. And after the game, Thorpe said, "He's the best back he's ever seen."
Pollard led his Akron team to an 8-0-3 season and the very first pro football title. According to Stephen Towns, after that, the star player of the Decatur Staleys let the football world know that he, too, disapproved of Pollard's presence.
George Halas said he'd never play a team with the N-word on it again.
George Halas was one of the NFL's founders and a future Hall of Famer. Despite Halas's hatred, or maybe because of it, Pollard was a major draw. Some fans showed up to see him run, others to see him get pummeled. Some credit Pollard and Jim Thorpe with saving the league, which struggled early on to compete with baseball, boxing, and horse racing. Because of his star power, Pollard was well paid. He made $1,500 a game by one estimate. That's about $20,000 these days. In 1921, Pollard became the NFL's first black head coach when he was named Akron's player coach. In 1923, he became the first black professional quarterback. But Stephen Towns says his grandfather didn't receive the respect he should have.
Unfortunately, he used to have to get dressed in his car. Can you imagine that? Your star player having to get dressed in his car and then come onto the field?
In some ways, it's hard to quantify just how good Fritz Pollard was as a player, because stats from the 1920s are unreliable and incomplete. Fritz Pollard's pro football playing career ended in 1926. The following year, there were no African Americans in pro football. Pollard had already begun a career as an entrepreneur. He had established the first black-owned investment firm in the U.S. in 1922. He would go on to be a newspaper mogul and talent agent for many black entertainers, including Lena Horne and Pollard's former Akron Pros teammate, Paul Robeson. Pollard flourished as a businessman, but in the early 30s, he noticed a disturbing development in the NFL. And it motivated him. Again, Aaron Dodson.
In 1933, the league sort of enacted this gentleman's agreement that barred African-American players from the league. And he took it upon himself to continue those opportunities for those black players who had proven, like himself, that they were able to play in the National Football League at the highest level.
Pollard's response was to barnstorm with a team that included Jackie Robinson's older brother, Mac, and Paul Robeson. They called themselves the Brown Bombers.
Named after Joe Louis.
Dr. Charles Ross is director of African American Studies at the University of Mississippi.
They play out of Harlem. He was the coach of that team. And ultimately, he really wanted for them to showcase their talents and potentially apply pressure to NFL owners to have to answer as to why black players were not on these NFL rosters to say, "Hey, you know, we're pretty successful. We're very competitive against these white semi-pro teams. How come they aren't given this opportunity to play in the National Football League?"
Fritz Pollard III says they were more than competitive.
The Brown Bombers were 29-0. Never lost a game. Their talent was just so incredible. It had to have been some kind of team.
Stephen Towns agrees.
They were beating some of the pro teams so badly that they had to hold the score down because they were afraid that they weren't going to play them anymore. So it was a little bit more than an exhibition game. When you got white players at that point in time playing black players, it meant something.
The Brown Bombers folded in 1938, one of the many casualties of the Great Depression. It's hard to know exactly how much pressure Pollard's barnstorming team put on the NFL, but the league finally reintegrated in 1946. Fritz Pollard faded out of the public eye in the decades following the demise of the Brown Bombers. Again, Aaron Dodson.
He really didn't talk about his legacy in terms of the league. He was a very reserved man, and once his football career was over, it was over.
Pollard focused on his family and his businesses. He watched from a distance as Jim Thorpe, George Preston Marshall, and George Halas, who had opposed the inclusion of black players in the pros, were inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame's inaugural class of 1963. But as time went on, Pollard's legend grew until some of the league's most powerful men took notice. One of them was NFL Commissioner Paul Tagliabue, who, according to Stephen Towns, would hand out books celebrating his grandfather's life.
Tagliabue told me that he kept a case of books, and he said he would pass those out to people who would come into his office because he was just so amazed at my grandfather's accomplishment.
Frederick Douglass Fritz Pollard died in 1986 at the age of 92. He was finally inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2005, along with Dan Marino, Steve Young, and Benny Friedman. Stephen Towns was at the ceremony. So was Fritz Pollard III. He says his grandfather was too positive to allow the Hall's refusal to induct him in his lifetime to get him down. But that was no excuse for the delay.
He should have been in the founding class. There's no doubt about it. And most of the Hall of Famers say he should have been in the founding class.
Pollard's influence lives on, thanks in part to the efforts of the Fritz Pollard Alliance, which promotes equal NFL coaching and front office opportunities for minorities. Former NFL player and FPA chairman John Wooten says Pollard was the obvious choice to be that organization's inspiration.
All-American, first black to play in the Rose Bowl, outstanding coming from Brown. So when we started the organization, that's why we took the name that we took.
Wooten is perhaps fighting an uphill battle these days, as evidenced by the recent controversy surrounding the Oakland Raiders' recent hiring of John Gruden to a 10-year head coaching deal without interviewing a single minority candidate, as per the NFL's Rooney Rule. Dr. Charles Ross worries that the league and a younger generation of fans still doesn't appreciate Pollard's significance.
It's really a shame that he's someone that really remains kind of in the shadows. He's someone that really deserves a lot more exposure, a lot more recognition based upon the circumstances that he faced and what he was able to achieve.
Consider the progress that's been made in the three decades since the death of Fritz Pollard. He's now a Hall of Famer. A watchdog organization bears his name. Black quarterbacks are no longer considered novelties. Maybe in this sense, Fritz Pollard just keeps getting up.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach talking with Dr. Charles Ross and the grandson of Fritz Pollard. We'll have a video of the 1916 Rose Bowl on our website, onlyagame.org. Coming up, a story about running and mental illness.
The eating disorder was what I believed would keep me running fast. And then the depression was just associated with the ups and downs of success.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Each and every morning, there are a whole lot of places you can look for news. Try this instead, though. Listen to Up First. Up First is the morning news podcast from NPR. One tap, and 10 minutes later, you have started the day informed. Find Up First on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the story of perhaps the world's most monotonous marathon course and the walls that surround it. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill, and welcome to our new friends at WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Let's talk some football. You said last week that your head told you that Alabama would win the collegiate national championship, and your heart said it would be Georgia, and your head was right.
Yeah, but just barely. We had a photo finish between my head and my heart, which which was very uncomfortable in my
chest. I bet it was.
But it was a terrific game. Most of the big plays being made by actual, what they call true freshmen.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was an extraordinary football game. I enjoyed myself watching it.
And the fact that those true freshmen made the plays suggests that Alabama will be pretty good for a couple more years.
I was about to say that Nick Saban's job is fairly secure.
The pesky University of Central Florida is at it again. After claiming the national title before the title game, asserting that its undefeated record merited that, some fans have purchased a billboard challenging Alabama to a game. Are you ready for some more college football?
Well, actually, the billboard is asking for trouble because the billboard is not asking for a game this year. It's asking for a home-and-home series starting next year, after, at which point the University of Central Florida has already lost its head coach to Nebraska. So, you know, I think asking for a home and home, and in essence asking for a game 3 years from now, might be asking for trouble.
Charlie, last week we mentioned the parade in Cleveland following the Browns' 0-16 season. Some of the Cleveland players were upset that there was a parade, but it did raise over $17,000 for the Greater Cleveland Food Bank, so perhaps they'll take some solace from that, though not, fans hope, enough solace to go 0-16 again next year.
I was about to say, this is a great thing. It raised a lot of money for a food bank, and if the players don't want a parade for an 0-16 team next year, they should win some football games.
One, at least. We are just past the halfway point in the National Hockey League season, and I'm going to give you a hint about who's on top in the Pacific Division. You cannot see the Pacific from where they are.
It's the Vegas Golden
Yes,
Knights.
Yes, it is.
Owners of the greatest Twitter feed in all of sports.
Are the Golden Knights inexplicably good, or is the NHL's Pacific Division very, very thin?
I think the Pacific Division is a little bit thin, but Marc-Andre Fleury, the goalie they picked up, is having a terrific season. If you're not following them on Twitter, please do, because the Twitter feed is this kind of mock, we're just learning about hockey thing.
Yeah, it's an expansion
It's extremely
team.
Funny.
Grambling State guard Shekyla Hill recently became the fourth woman in the history of women's college basketball to tally a quadruple-double when her team beat Alabama State. Here are the numbers. 15 points, 10 rebounds, 10 assists, and 10 steals. It's that last one that kind of sticks out, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how good Alabama State is with the basketball, but it's a heck of an accomplishment. And the great thing is that she got her assist on the very last play of the game.
Yep.
She got the quadruple-double right before the buzzer.
Yasuhiro Suzuki, Japanese kayaker, has been banned from his sport for 8 years for a drug-related incident. 8 years? That must have been some infraction.
Yeah, he dosed one of his competitors.
Oh, okay. It's a little different from just taking.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is everybody's excuse when they get caught, but this actually happened.
Men's Health magazine has been asking various notable males to comment on the Me Too movement, and I wonder if they're sorry that one of the guys they chose to interview was boxer Floyd Mayweather.
Yeah, because he doesn't seem to understand what the Me Too movement is.
Nope.
When it was explained to him that the Me Too movement was women speaking out about sexual assault, his answer was, when somebody is like, I got a Rolls Royce, I'd be like, me too. Mm. No, no, no.
No, no,
Floyd. Floyd, no.
No.
No, no. Don't do any more interviews, Floyd, for the rest of your life.
And finally, Charlie, pro soccer players, like pro athletes in other sports, change teams all the time. What makes Romelu Lukaku's departure from Everton for Manchester United so noteworthy?
The majority shareholder of the Everton club blamed Mr. Lukaku's switch on voodoo.
Oh.
Instead of, like, money, which is, you know, the only really effective form of, like, of voodoo I know.
Instead of, like, which would you rather play for, Everton or Manchester
United? See, I don't know anything about it. I know Manchester United is a fairly famous team. I don't know from Everton, but I just want
to... That's my point! You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Our next story is about a runner who had to slow down before she could speed back up. Reporter Eilish O'Neill has the story.
Caitlin Dow grew up in upstate New York in a little town in the Catskill Mountains.
I was a pretty free spirit, you know, funny kid apparently.
That all changed when Kate started running.
Running brought out the perfectionist in me.
It started in junior high when a softball coach noticed how fast Kate could run the bases and told her she should try out for the cross-country team. She was good, really good, right away. In seventh grade, she came in second in the New York State meet. Newspapers called her a phenom. She says she didn't feel like a free spirit anymore.
I always had this fear that somebody was going to catch up to me.
Kate noticed other female runners hitting puberty and dropping off the radar. She didn't want that to happen to her. And then she went to the cross-country junior Olympics in Reno, Nevada. All the athletes stayed in a hotel together and spent the evening hanging out.
One of the cross-country runners was like 4 years older than me, and I had a crush on him. He called me Hefty, or Beefy. Beefy was the word. You know, that was just another encouragement for me to be smaller.
Kate says that's the moment she decided to do whatever she could to delay puberty.
And I was going to keep my body the size that it was, which was 70-something pounds and 5'1", I think, in seventh grade.
Kate started obsessing about her weight. Her parents made her go to therapy, but she cheated on her weigh-ins and threw tantrums when anyone tried to make her eat more. And so she did manage to delay puberty. When she was in high school, she took hormone pills in order to finally start her period. And she also managed to stay fast. Fast enough that Georgetown University offered her a full scholarship to run on their cross-country team. Her sophomore year, she became their top runner. She told a New York Times reporter she had recovered from anorexia, and she was happy. But neither of those things was true.
My mental status was mostly depressed if I wasn't having success in running. Running was my identity. The eating disorder was what I believed would keep me running fast. And then the depression was just associated with the ups and downs of success.
And because of her anorexia, Kate had fragile, brittle bones.
I had, you know, close to osteoporosis, the bone density of a 60 or 80-year-old when I was 18.
That meant she was susceptible to stress fractures.
I would train for 8 weeks, get in good shape, and then got injured again. It was like 8 weeks on, 8 weeks off, 8 weeks on, 8 weeks off.
Kate often raced on broken bones. Heading into cross-country nationals her fourth year of college, she had a tibial stress fracture.
Or it could have been a fibula, or tibia and a fibula. I had so many, I just can't even remember.
Either way, Kate still raced. She was projected to finish in the top three.
And I took a bunch of a leave before. I was in second place for much of the race. Then I got passed in the last like half mile by a bunch of people. And I remember flying home and just being in agony.
The following year, 1999, was Kate's final year of college. Before her last collegiate race, she was projected to be All-American for the sixth time, but she was one of the last to finish.
I just decided after that race that I just couldn't do it anymore. I just needed to get away and start over and start fresh where nobody knew me. And so that's when I moved from DC to California.
Kate started school to become a physician's assistant, and she took up cycling. It's not that she didn't want to run.
I still missed it. I still loved it. I still wanted to be that runner. I still identified myself as a runner.
So every once in a while, Kate tried to go for a run. But she'd always start fast, at pretty high mileage, and get injured within a week or two. Her bones couldn't hold up to the pounding.
I completely gave up the idea of me ever competing again, really. I never thought I would compete again. My sister was having great success in marathons, and she ran on the Olympic Trials marathon. And I was jealous, but I didn't think that that was something that I would be able to do. Never thought my body would be able to withstand training or running that much.
When Kate was in college, she logged about 100 miles every week and a half. After college, it took her a decade and a half to log that many miles. But that doesn't mean she wasn't exercising. She'd go to the gym for an hour every morning and then ride her bike for a few hours every night.
You know, putting in 2 to 5 hours a day of exercise. So, and that's kind of who I became, this just crazy exerciser. That was my identity at that point.
That went on for years. Then, in the winter of 2011, when Kate was 34 years old, things got even worse.
A and my body just started to break down. I couldn't even go for a half an hour ride. I was going to go for a vacation to the Grand Canyon, go hike that, and it ended up I just canceled that trip and stayed in bed for like 10 days.
Kate says she spent that time watching Scrubs and crying under the covers. She says she was suffering from complete exhaustion and severe depression.
I have always been someone who's had a lot of energy. So being in bed for so many days was something that was foreign to me and something that made me feel finally really sick. Something was really wrong with my body.
Kate says she decided she was going to get better.
I had been through short bursts of therapy in the past when I was forced to do it, but I think I was just ready for therapy. I was just such, like, help me.
Kate started taking antidepressants and she stopped exercising.
I think that's a really critical part of getting better from an eating disorder is just letting your body rest and recover and not doing any exercise at all, and getting the nutrition in and letting your body realize that you're not starving it or abusing it anymore.
Kate spent all her time outside of work going to her therapist, her doctor, her nutritionist. Her body started to heal. That summer, at the age of 34, she got her period naturally for the first time in her life. Kate says she'd always before been focused internally on her own eating, exercise, weight. That summer, she started to focus on other people, too. She fell in love.
Did not think I had the possibility of getting pregnant. I figured I was barely getting my period for a couple months, and it wasn't going to be possible. And then I got pregnant in November.
But given her medical history, she was really worried she'd lose the baby.
I would take a pregnancy test every couple days to make sure that I was still pregnant.
Kate's baby girl was born in July 2012. She named her Grace.
It just puts everything in perspective and has made my priorities not about me, they're about her. Being like, I need to take care of myself for her because I need to set a good example for her. I need to be around for her. I need to have energy so I can play with her.
Kate's recovery was not completely linear. She went through a few dark months when Grace was an infant. She was unemployed and moved back in with her parents in upstate New York. She says her eating disorder started to come back. But when Grace was about a year old, Kate got a job in Tacoma, Washington, near where her older sister lives. So she and her baby moved.
That's when I started running again.
Kate would put one-year-old Grace in the jogging stroller.
My problem in the past had been always trying to run fast as soon as I started, and the stroller slowed me down. You know, she was a baby who wanted to be in my arms at all times, so that was the only time that I had my arms free of a baby. And then it was just amazing to me that I could do it and not hurt. And I could run, you know, 5 times a week, 6 miles or whatever it was, and not hurt.
Kate says she had no plans to race, but that fall, her sister invited her to do a turkey trot 5K.
And I was just like, okay, let's do this with my sister kind of thing.
Kate raced pretty well. A lot faster than she'd expected.
That was the first time I was like, oh, wow, maybe I can, you know, race again.
Kate gradually upped her training, but she didn't take it too far this time, and she made sure to get enough nutrition. She ran her first half marathon and then her first marathon. She's now considered an elite runner. She's part of a professional team and has sponsors. Kate's still a perfectionist about her running, but in the normal way every runner I know is. I wrote to her to ask how the California International Marathon went in early December, and she wrote back, "It did not go well. I went out too fast and died hard. I qualified for the 2020 Olympic trials, which is cool, but I'm frustrated with how I ran." But overall, Caitlin Dow says she's happy.
I was reborn. I mean, things have not been perfect. There's been some ups and downs, but I feel so blessed, and it's just been like a different life. I'm so grateful to be where I am now.
That's Kate Landau speaking with reporter Eilish O'Neill. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Peta Taufatofua, who complains about the Wi-Fi in his hotel room, which made for a tricky Skype connection.
I think the Wi-Fi is as slow as I was on snow.
Don't you love a self-deprecatory athlete? Go Tonga! I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more Sports NPR style on Only Game, and thanks for listening.